Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. All right, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Stoppelman. And Fred and I just continued our conversation from the previous episode about how do we get reliability into like a fast, lean startup model development process. How can we help out? And one of the thoughts we had was we hope we don't have to wait for field failures to happen before the value of reliability is recognized and
yeah,
and we're included in the discussions.
A smoking melted product is always a good communication tool. It gets everybody's attention, but it's a hard way to do it. Customers are involved at that point.
Yeah, and I think there's some value in getting involved with field failures. And Fred, you mentioned you then become the bearer of bad news, and nobody likes you anymore when you bring those field failures. And I want to take it a little bit further in that I've worked with a company before that in their products had issues with updating firmware in the field. And I was able to see that across different product lines, there were always different reasons why there were issues with the firmware. But the question is there a common cause that a root cause that in the process on how we develop and deploy the firmware that just makes it easy for that update process to break? Mm-hmm. And I think that's an opportunity for a reliability engineer to start digging deeper than just the developers that roll out a patch and call it good and move on until there's the next, you know, upgrade failure.
Well, there's something to that. To me, it's part of building credibility. So before we dive into that, let's take a short pause.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett. I just wanted to take a moment to thank Minitab Software for their support of Apex Ridge Reliability and the Ascendo community. If you'd like to learn more about their statistical software packages, please go to ascendoreliability.com/go/Minitab.
Yeah, you know, Chris, solving the process of rolling out firmware updates to me doesn't sound like a reliability problem. One, you shouldn't have to roll out patches or updates, but we do. And there's all kinds of continuous improvement reasons for doing things like that. Yet the description you just laid out there is it's this ongoing problem, and each team may face it, and they may think that's unique to their own team. And you've seen it certainly as each team becomes its own silo to a large degree. And they may talk once a quarter with the other groups or at lunch if they happen to have those relationships. But oftentimes we're pretty siloed for all kinds of different reasons. But I see that mindset way too often. And oftentimes reliability folks are supporting two or three different products or different teams. And we have a unique view in those cases. But solving that systemic problem is good for not only that one team we're working with, which is a challenge, right? Because they're going to look at it going, why are you solving this bigger problem? We only want to solve this one, this small one. And, well, you're going to keep solving that over and over again unless we fix the overall process. Part of this is the ability to facilitate and to communicate and to identify these issues that are more systemic and go off and solve those things. And doing that kind of stuff, it has tangential benefits to reliability. But my opinion, though, is that oftentimes it creates more credibility for the person as an engineer, as a person that solves the big problems.
Yeah, it depends on what kind of view you take on what reliability encompasses. And to me, it's a very broad field. Even fixing a business process or the process of how we develop things can mm-hmm. affect reliability, just as the manufacturing process and mm-hmm. having SPC charts affects reliability. Mm-hmm. But also often development teams look at reliability as the guys that come in and test their product and tell them it's good or bad.
More often we tell them it's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we test long enough, we will find something, you know, but yeah, you're right. It's, you know, I think the view of reliability is just the test group at the end of the line. Like the police, we talked about that in the last episode. It's not really a useful role. Testing has a function. It has a role to help us answer questions, but it's not where reliability gets built into a product. That's much earlier. And if you wait until you get field failures to convince them that they got a problem, right? That's after the fact. The damage has been done. And in some companies, in some product lines, they're done. There's no more product. So it's, how do you communicate the importance of reliability up front? And part of that is when you're facing lots of resistance, you got a lot of barriers, and like this firmware problem you're describing, is solve that, right? You've done something, you didn't just bring them bad news, you solved the problem and it's gone away. And take credit for it. Make sure everybody knows you did it, kind of thing. And it builds credibility, which is a big part of being effective in as a reliability engineer, is that you're a credible source of information and helping people solve problems.
Yeah, and by demonstrating that you're using science-based approaches and statistics and data and bring those into discussions, all too often, you know, it's just a bunch of opinions in a meeting and gut feelings, and decisions are made based on those. And mm-hmm. it's a good meeting when somebody comes with data and we make a decision based on the data.
Yeah.
And that's another way to show the credibility of having that rigor of science-based approach in the problem-solving process.
Yeah, I used to work for a general manager that is, you know, his mantra was basically speak with data. He just, if you didn't come in with the analysis and a credible source for the information, the meeting was over. There was no decision going to be made on your opinion. And the marketing guy hated it because he had to go off and do all these studies. Because up until then, he could just go, well, we think the market's going to do this. Well, where's your data for that? How do you know that? And he was shut down. He didn't have anything. But it applied to everybody across the organization. I could hear him saying it, speak with data, bring me the data.
And that's where we can tie back to Eric Ries's lean startup model, where you do your hypothesis testing of what you think the customer wants, and you come back, you test it, and you get some data, whether your assumptions were right or not.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen that in a product, especially one that was, I don't think it was called Internet of the Thing at the time. It was a little fitness tracker kind of device, and it would sync up through an app to a central server, essentially. And one of the questions they had was, well, how often would somebody wear this? How often do they use it? Would it be people that are just going out for a run or for a walk, or would they wear it all day? And it would be slightly different decisions they would need to make on the next product, depending on how was the use really done. And because they were storing this data, they were able to look at it going, well, these 3,000 people only wore it for 2 hours every week, right? But these 40,000 people wore it pretty much all the time, except when it was charging. They wore it 16 hours a day, every day. And so they decided to optimize for that large audience, and it made some changes to their product and their decisions going on. But that was a perfect approach for them, and they had the ability to collect that information. You know, if it's a ship it and never see it again, that's harder to do.
Yeah, if you can collect data with your product while it's in use, that's definitely valuable. Companies like Tesla are doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Gathering huge amounts of data, and that's maybe another topic for the future, is, you know, field data,
mm-hmm.
and how to collect it.
Yeah. But, it all depends on your product. If it's part of the service is that it's talking to the mothership, essentially, then there's lots of opportunities there to do those hypothesis tests. I mean, it's not impossible otherwise. You just go talk to your customers and ask them, find out what's going on. So I'm sure it's still possible. We've come back to this Lean Startup book by Eric. There's lots of tools, there's lots of data, yet have you ever run into an engineer that, here's your test data, here's the results, here's the measurements, here's all the charts and graphs, and they go, oh, I don't believe that. I've been an engineer for 400 years and blah, 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 that'll never work. what do you do then? I'm sure you've run into it.
Yeah, that's a good question, Brad.
It's not unrealistic. I'm sure you've run into it. And it's one of those that, I'm all right, fine. One is, all right, if you don't believe it, will you at least agree to a comparison? Let's run it that way and this way. Let's make two prototypes and test them. And let's see which one works. Or, all right, great. Let's put it in the record. And, I hope I don't have to say I told you so, which you shouldn't say anyway, but let's monitor this. Let's track it. And if it's, creating havoc in the manufacturing process and we lose a lot of yield, or we're getting early failures, or or it might work, and then give credit where credit is due.
I think if you come with data and they don't believe the data, you probably have to ask, what part of the data do you not believe, or what makes you doubt the data? And I think it comes down to assumptions. What kind of assumptions did we make when we collected the data, or what kind of assumptions did the other person make about their design? Maybe start listing those and get down to the disconnect of, why don't you believe the data I'm bringing? And okay, so you don't disagree with my method. Let's try a different method.
And that's true. I that's a good way to approach it, is especially with field data. I remember, I probably have talked about this story one time, is I got called down to the shipping docks and the guy says, we just got this huge field batch of products back on a field failure. You got to see this. This is amazing. And I was expecting to see a big heap of mangled and burnt out printers, inkjet printers and it was a pallet of printers as they leave the factory. We would ship these things in these bulk packs, and it was a robot arm would stack these in a particular pattern, and then it was wrapped up and packaged and then it would be broken down and put into boxes and the literature added to it and then be sent out to stores. It was sent back to us from a distribution center from, Best Buy or somebody like that. And it was, the root cause was that they got a full refund if it was a warranty return, and they got an 80% refund refund if it was an overstocking return. And so they ordered a 500 too many printers, so they sent back the entire pallet under a warranty claim saying they all don't work. They didn't even open them. It was still factory packed. So he said, there's something wrong with this process, this business process. So we went off and tracked that down and closed that loophole as best we could. But it was, the guy downstairs was ready to, he says, this came back under this warranty claim and I have to go do a root cause analysis on all these printers to find out what's wrong with them. And I think, you're going to get a lot of no trouble found here. I hope they're not all dead on arrival.
Right.
It's like, I never thought a reliability engineer would be dealing with, the reverse supply chain of overstocking orders and stuff like that and getting the forecast right. But that's what we spent some time on, and it reduced our warranty expense significantly and improved the accuracy of the ordering process to these big stores. And it was completely out of the realm of what I was typically doing at the time. But you got to do it, right? You got to solve those problems that make a difference.
Yeah, in the end, we all work to improve the bottom line of the company, right?
Yeah.
And so warranty costs us.
I'm just there for the donuts.
Those are good too, yeah.
Yeah. No, but you're right. Warranty costs is a big factor. And too many organizations, and you've seen it, is the design team, it gets done with it, they throw it over to operations, and they never see the warranty again. They might get called in on one or two problems, but that's it.
Yeah, it comes out of a completely different budget most of the time, and they're not responsible or being held accountable.
That's right.
For the costs incurred in the life cycle of the product.
All right. So part of what we've talked about, though, I'm going to summarize a little bit, is, I mean, it's reliability engineers is speaking with data, using a coherent, logical approach to identify and solve problems. I would add that it's also in how we communicate and bring about the awareness part to what we're doing, help people facilitate and solve problems. Those are what I would call the soft skills part of it, is how we go about doing our job and how we work with other people. Is that a fair summary of what we're talking about here with all this?
Yeah, that's what we set out to talk about. And I think we touched on some of that. And, another example would be helping people out when they don't know what to do about a quality or reliability problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had situations where I was working with the engineering team in manufacturing, and they didn't quite understand their processes, and they were given those processes by the equipment vendor, and they just set it up and ran it. And when we started having quality problems, they didn't know what to do about it. So we mm-hmm. helped them run a DOE on the process to explore the process window.
I think
we really gotta take the mindset of partners, and we already talked about it in the last episode. You know, not be the police, but be the partner. We've got the tool set and the skills to help our teammates out in the aspects of quality, reliability, making their product better, and making improvements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and it's one of those where I don't see it too often, and it's maybe because I only work with good people, I guess. I don't know, but it's, you know, oh, that process equipment, that's a manufacturing engineer's problem or a process engineer's problem. I don't deal with that. That's somebody else. Like you, most people I've dealt with are there's an issue. I have tools that can help solve that one. Let's talk about it. Let's solve that one. And I think if more people did that, I think we'd have a whole lot better products all the way around, but we're still fighting to a large degree, a lot of segregation and siloing of our organizations. Now, do you see that siloing? I'm going to go back to the lean startup, and you've had some experience in these smaller, trying to go fast, small groups is, and I've seen some of it in with startups I've actually worked with, is there's, I don't see the siloing, right? They're just too busy. They're head down. I'm trying to solve what's on my plate today. It's silo is to the individual. It was one part of it, but there's also in better managed teams, they actually start to work well with each other to help solve each other's problems and team up on stuff and solve it. What do you see? What's your take on the effect of these fast teams?
I've seen both. I've seen where you didn't even know where one department started or ended because teams work together so well
mm-hmm.
In a cross-functional matrix, and you rarely ever heard this is not my job, you know. But I've also seen it even in startup environments where nobody wants to take ownership of an issue
mm-hmm.
or engineering teams just keep to themselves and don't want to deal with quality, reliability, or the operations team.
Right.
So when it comes time to taking the design and turning it now into a product and ramping it, you know, there's a whole lot of roadblocks that now happen because things get handed over and weren't thought about, and we have to go back and address a lot of issues before we can actually start manufacturing this in higher volumes. And that's maybe they didn't anticipate those issues, or they're thinking they can just hand it off and somebody will make it for them, and without ever having thought about is it manufacturable or not.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of that is the leadership teams, and as a reliability engineer, we can help. For example, one of the things that creates this very siloed or just throw it over the wall or you know, it's not my job kind of thing is fear. You know, you mentioned that they don't want to take responsibility for something. If they say, all right, this is a bad part or we need to fix this, if they get criticized and demoted and they get poor assignments after that, their chair is moved into the back dark corner kind of thing, they're not going to speak up anymore, right? And reliability is prone to that. If you're not celebrating failures and getting the most value out of those, instead that somebody gets blamed for it and they're in trouble or they're in the doghouse, nobody's going to have failures anymore. Nobody's going to do anything to find failures. That's where the leadership part in the culture of an organization really come to play is collaborative or blame. It's kind of the two ends of the spectrum, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I can see in defense of the development team, sometimes they're so busy and they have so much on their plate, they don't want to do somebody else's job. And I think that's where sometimes that attitude comes from. Well, this is not my job, let somebody else do it.
In some cases, that makes sense.
But at the same time, it needs to get done. So, you know, the ultimate goal of launching the product can be achieved.
Yeah. And I think, you know, from the reliability side is I've worked with an electrical engineer that was just swamped. And he looked at me one day when I walked in his office and he goes, oh, you only bring me bad news. You know, I says, well, what can I do to, you know, create so that you have time to focus on some of these reliability questions? What can I do to help? And he says, if I push save on my file here for this electrical circuit board, I want you to, and I was working in as a reliability engineer out of a manufacturing side of the organization. We were so tired of the operations guys were so tired of poor reliability. They hired a bunch of us to go improve the design. Well, the design guys didn't want to talk to us. We were just in the way. So he said, if I can hit save on this design and you can walk in the door a few minutes later with the product, the prototype, then I don't have this dead space in my calendar waiting to see how my design works. I can start troubleshooting it and improving it right away. And the current prototyping turnaround was 2 weeks, what we were doing at the moment. So we went off, the team I was working on, we went off and did a bunch of research and sorted out all the steps it took from here's something we want to make as a prototype to when it actually comes in the door. And there was a procurement guy that would not order anything on the bill of materials until he had the final design. And so I go back to Ed and he said, well, usually I'm trying to decide like two components or maybe five components are in play in the last month of my design process. Everything else is set. I'm not dealing with them. I'm trying to do some analysis. I'm doing circuit calculations. I'm doing breadboards. I'm trying to design the last 10 components. You know, I'll pick three of those to fit in. And so we went back to the procurement guys and said, you need to order this expanded bill of materials that includes all of the options the designer's considering. Oh, we can't do that. We can't buy parts we're not going to use, blah, blah, blah. And so we got the data. If we would have bought all of those extra parts we knew we were not going to use, had a high probability of not using, it would have cost us another $1,000. And then I went to the program manager and I said, if you get your prototype here in 3 days instead of 2 weeks, what good is that? What value does that provide? He goes, well, it saves us $7 million. My team is actively working on the product and using those prototypes as they should 7 days sooner. So those 7 days at $1 million a day to run this lab saves me $7 million. It's like, okay, do you want to call the procurement guy and say his saving $1,000 is costing you $7 million? And he says, yep, I will make that phone call. So I had one of the he was a senior manager in the group, and they fixed that problem real quick. And the next prototype showed up in 3 days. And, you know, we just had nothing to do with reliability, but Ed sure loved seeing me show up, and we had much better discussions after that. And we got all kinds of good stuff done after that. He still didn't do any of the reliability stuff, but but we had more fun.
I think that's a good example of the problem of different teams having different goals and metrics they're measured by, right?
Mm-hmm. The procurement guy was not going to waste a penny, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And so the overall picture gets lost, and everybody's just working towards their little sets of goals, and it doesn't always roll up into the big picture of the company. That's where we as reliability engineers, as we span and interface with so many different departments, you know, can help out showing people the bigger picture sometimes, or helping them realize there's a bigger picture to what's going on.
Yeah. You know, and most people recognize that. It's just making it visible, making it apparent, and showing the trade-offs. Good summary.
And like you said, you know, put it in dollars. That's the language that management speaks.
Yep.
You have a good example of that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, you know, it's not something that just you and I face. I think a lot of our listeners face the same thing. So, you know, if you're listening to this and your head's nodding, if you have an example of this where you've, you know, stepped out of the traditional reliability role and helped your teams solve problems, and whether it's like you were doing, Chris, with the DOE on a process piece of equipment, or sorting out a paperwork glitch or different priorities, those kinds of things, you know, let us know. Head over to reliability.fm. You can find Speaking of Reliability along with the other shows in the network. And there's plenty of opportunities there for comment fields and suggestions. And we're all pretty visible on the about pages. There's all ways to get in touch with us. So let us know. Let us know what you think. Any good stories, we'd love to share those. And if you have any specific questions, you know, they'd like to ask Chris and I, you know, let us know. We'd love to bring that up in a future episode. You know, and Chris, we've just done two episodes. And I'm looking forward to doing some more with you. Are you up to do some more episodes going forward?
Yeah, absolutely, Fred.
All right, great. So we'll look for the audience to feed us some information and some direction, and maybe we'll get some juicy problems to talk about and some interesting ideas. If not, we've got plenty of them that we already are dealing with, so we can talk about those too. That won't be any problem. All right, so thanks so much, Chris. We'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thank you, Fred. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.